Hello, and welcome to the Nutrition and Life Podcast. This is where we look at various nutrition and fitness-related topics through the lens of application. We want to give you practical takeaways so that you can create your healthiest, best self backed by knowledge. Now, onto the episode with your host, Coach Lisa.
Hello, and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life Podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Calvin Scheller. He is a nutrition coach and the author of an amazing article in the most recent Allen Aragon Research Review on insulin. Welcome to the show, Calvin.
Hey there, thank you for having me.
Well, it's my absolute pleasure. And before we kind of get into the research aspect of things, I would just simply love to hear who you are and how you got into fitness, nutrition, and of course, research.
Yeah, so I'd say it's been a little bit bumpy. So it started off with actually when I was about 13, I would say, I had essentially a severe IBS attack. It's still to this day, I do face some of the symptoms of it. So inability to absorb a lot of certain foods, and then just inability to actually eat a lot of foods. So my diet is fairly restricted. Luckily, I can still eat, you know, all the whole foods. You know, I can still eat meat, eggs, fruits, vegetables, things like that. But, you know, I need to be wary with different additives and even gluten and dairy, unfortunately. But at that point, I started consuming a little bit more content about nutrition because I was essentially precipitously losing weight unintentionally, just because I couldn't eat. So I started doing a little bit of research and I came across podcasts and I kind of got obsessed with podcasts. And that was around the same time that, within the next 1 or 2 years, COVID-19 hit. So we ended up being locked away for a little bit. And essentially within that time, I just kind of dove headfirst into reading. So I got a lot of my information, even right off the bat, from, you know, trying to find the best sources. And eventually I curated the best sources that I can find. So finding most of my resources off of places like PubMed and things like that. But at the time I was reading for, you know, upwards of 8 hours a day, just because there was nothing else to do. We were in lockdown and I continue to kind of foster this passion. So I'm always reading. So, you know, as today in my free time, I'll probably be reading. I'm not one to, you know, I never had video games. I didn't really watch television as a kid. So I was a bit of a weird kid, but so my free time is really spent reading. And at first it was, you know, it all sounded like gibberish essentially because I didn't understand most of it. And then as I continued to read, I kind of understood what things read. It didn't take me as long to get through articles. And today I'm pretty efficient at actually getting through articles, sorting through methods or whether or not it's a meta-analysis, things like that, and kind of coming to the conclusions I really want to find. And as unfortunate as it is, a lot of the things that I heard early on go against what's actually being demonstrated in the literature. So, you know, a lot of the things that you hear on social media are simply, you know, in theory, they sound really enticing. But when you actually look into it, a lot of them aren't really founded by anything other than, well, this is what should happen. So I started to really go against a lot of the things that I believed when I was younger. And then at that point, I decided to start kind of publishing a little bit of, you know, more educational content on social media, and people really picked up on it. And a lot of times it was saying things that they've heard before, but kind of telling them that it may not actually be true, which kind of is the scope of my social medias nowadays, is really kind of going against some of the common narratives that are out there that may not actually be validated. And people really, really enjoy that. And they enjoy when I, you know, as nerdy as it sounds, when I show all the studies in the background, people enjoy that. So doing my best to take some complex information and really try and simplify it for everyone to understand.
And you do such a great job at it. I will obviously make sure to link your social media handles in the show notes also so people can go and check out your content. But I mean, for everyone listening, Calvin is just 18 years old and obviously like very well read when it comes to all things nutrition and fitness from what I can gather. And as I have alluded to, your most recent article in the Allen Aragon Research Review was on insulin. So I'm super curious to hear what made you want to dig into that particular topic? It's not necessarily, well, for any kind of nutrition and fitness coach, I don't think that that's like the first thing on our minds necessarily, unless we deal with people with insulin resistance, diabetes, et cetera. But just in general, what made you interested in that topic? And also when you were researching it and writing about it, was there anything like that really blew your mind and you were like, oh, I never looked at it that way? And I think that's really understood by a lot of people.
Yeah. So essentially I've had, you know, a few family members who suffer with things like diabetes. And as true as it is, a lot of the content on social media talks about insulin resistance. Not a lot of it, but, you know, more than you might expect. But a lot of it is kind of selling most of the people talking about insulin resistance are typically advocating for a low carbohydrate diet. So essentially the canonical view of insulin resistance on social media would be something such as an insulin dependent insulin resistance. What this means is every time you increase your insulin, your cells become more resistant to that insulin. Therefore, as a byproduct of this idea, it would be the limitation of carbohydrates that it would affect insulin sensitivity. So even in someone who is, you know, extremely lean, extremely healthy, if they eat too many carbohydrates or they're snacking too often and their insulin remains elevated, then they would become insulin resistant. And you hear that a lot on social media. And at the beginning of my journey, I fell into the low carbohydrate sphere. And I really did believe that, you know, if you completely eliminated carbohydrates, you would never get insulin resistant because there is an insulin dependent process that drives it. Because this does occur in many other places within the nervous system and the human body. You know, the more caffeine you ingest, the more sensitive you get to that caffeine. The same thing occurs with things like dopamine and even drugs. But insulin is a little bit different. It isn't the insulin itself that causes cells to stop responding to insulin. And for note, insulin resistance is typically the underlying pathology that drives diabetes. So diabetes is characterized by, especially type 2 diabetes, is characterized by elevations in blood glucose. And this typically occurs because cells are no longer uptaking that blood glucose out of the bloodstream. And insulin is the main hormone that essentially binds to its receptor and stimulates a cell to uptake that glucose. So when cells become resistant to insulin, meaning they stop responding, the cells are no longer getting the quote-unquote signal to uptake glucose out of the bloodstream. So then that would be what we refer to as insulin resistance. And you would think, again, or the kind of common narrative is that every time we have elevations in insulin, the cell becomes a little bit less responsive to this insulin. But one of the biggest things that I found actually researching insulin was that this is kind of a false premise. So the main driver of insulin resistance is actually the accumulation of fatty acids within our, specifically cells like our muscle and our liver. And these fatty acids can impair proper insulin signaling, which means that our cells are effectively insulin resistant, you know. So insulin can bind to its receptor all it would like, but these cells aren't responding properly. The same way that people can knock on your door all you would like, but you don't need to answer. So it's the accumulation of these fatty acids that actually drives insulin resistance. So when you look at it, if you overfeed individuals on carbohydrates or on dietary fat, it does actually appear that insulin sensitivity is more impaired when overfeeding on dietary fat rather than dietary carbohydrates. Even though the dietary carbohydrates drastically increase insulin levels, it doesn't impair the insulin signaling process. Whereas dietary fats, there is a mechanism by which they impair the insulin signaling process. If you want me to get in a little bit more detail with that, I can actually, you know, display that cool graphic that I have to show you that. But that's kind of the biggest thing to understand. And the other really cool thing that I found out researching it was inflammation actually also drives insulin resistance. So specific molecules that we produce during an inflammatory response, specifically things like interleukins. So let's say you have a tooth infection, your immune system will begin producing interleukins. These interleukins can bind to the same cells that insulin would typically bind to, such as muscle cells or fat cells, and they have a direct role at inhibiting proper insulin signaling. So there's actually a few studies that are quite funny, but also quite fascinating, that you know, in the presence of a tooth infection, people can have blood work that indicates that they're almost diabetic because they've become so insulin resistant as a result of increased inflammation that their blood glucose remains elevated because their cells are no longer responding to this insulin. So I would say the canonical view of insulin resistance being driven by carbohydrates simply is unfounded in a lot of the literature. And it's mainly driven by excess body weight, lack of exercise, and excess inflammation.
I really like how you state this so clearly in your article also. And again, I will link the article in, or not the article, but the link to sign up for the research review in the show notes. But what I thought when I was reading that at first also was, because you're starting off saying that oftentimes from carbohydrate feeding, overfeeding, you know, people think this is what results into insulin resistance. And then I thought to myself, well, actually, I know probably 3 to 5 people that are super, super lean and have insulin resistance. And so then carrying on and reading how you explain that it can also be starvation, quote unquote, starvation induced insulin resistance, I thought that was really interesting. And just kind of reassuring also that it doesn't always, especially I think in the nutrition coaching space, we might encounter that more often than we think, particularly if we perhaps work with competitors, or if we work with, you know, just women in general or people in general that might have come from years and years of under eating, that I think we might be surprised about that, because yeah, again, often we think it's only associated with excess body fat levels, and it's really not. And I think you explain that very nicely when it comes to the starvation induced insulin resistance. And also the other thing I was going to say is I think the stress that you mentioned there at the end, it probably all plays together, because of course being in a state of underfeeding for a prolonged amount of time, and then perhaps over-exercising, undersleeping, and all of that, it just adds on. And so you've basically already given us some really great practical takeaways here, in the sense of, hey, you know, make sure you're getting in your sleep, make sure you're somewhat active, but maybe also not really overdoing it in terms of your training. Otherwise, you're going to drive those inflammation markers up and up and up, up, up and up. And maybe also making sure you're periodizing your nutrition properly so that you're not always in a state of underfeeding. That was just something that came up for me. I don't know if you want to touch on starvation-induced insulin resistance just a tiny bit more, maybe.
What happens with insulin signaling is that insulin will bind to an insulin receptor. And in response to insulin binding, there's a lot of proteins that will function inside of the cell. They essentially change in the activity. And eventually, this leads to the cell beginning to uptake a lot of the circulating fuel molecules out of the bloodstream. So it'll uptake fatty acids, it'll uptake amino acids, and it'll uptake glucose. At the same time, it will use this glucose to burn for energy. It will use the fatty acids it uptakes to both burn for energy and store as intramuscular or intracellular lipids. The same thing occurs with glucose. It can store it as glycogen if it's in the muscles or in the liver. And with the amino acids, it can increase protein synthesis. So the best way to think about insulin is it increases the uptake of nutrients out of the bloodstream, and it increases the usage of these nutrients, whether it's for storage for later times in terms of fat, glycogen, or even muscle proteins, or if it's for direct oxidation, meaning burning. So it can increase the burning of glucose and fatty acids.
I just want to very briefly intersect here and like point out how positive all of that is, because I think oftentimes when we hear insulin, it's like people have like, oh no, I don't want to get my, you know, my insulin up too high or whatever. It's like this kind of like cortisol. It's become a word that people think is always negative, when of course, especially if we talk about muscle protein synthesis and just a lot of other things like inducing sleep or whatever, it's a very, very positive, powerful molecule, essentially. That's just what I wanted to interject here, but please carry on.
Absolutely, I agree with that. I mean, there's so many important functions of insulin. It helps us maintain our blood pressure by allowing us to reabsorb a lot of electrolytes from the kidneys. It can also directly increase the production of a lot of the hormones that regulate, you know, a lot of functions inside of the body. It increases steroidogenesis, so the production of things like testosterone and estrogen. it can also directly increase the production of things like leptin and thyroid hormones. Thyroid hormones are extremely important for our metabolic rate and just metabolic health in its entirety. And leptin, as most people know, has appetite-suppressing effects. So one thing that many people don't realize is insulin is one of the reasons that you feel satiated after the consumption of carbohydrates or just food in general. It can also, there's so many anabolic processes in our body that are important, building muscle, building bones, and then all of these things for maintaining micronutrients and things like that. There are effects of insulin that are pro-storage. But one of the best ways to describe insulin is that it's anti-catabolic. So it reduces our need or requirement to break down things like our muscles or to break down our stores of glycogen. So there's too many, you know, beneficial effects of insulin to completely, you know, mitigate. Trying to suppress it all the time may actually come at a detriment for many people. But importantly, the main underlying factor of insulin resistance is referred to as lipid metabolites. It's essentially these molecules of fat that can bind to specific proteins that function in response to insulin. So again, insulin never enters the cell, it binds to its receptor. And this receptor triggers a large cascade within inside of the cell that causes all of its functions. Essentially, these lipid metabolites mitigate all of the intracellular functions of insulin. So insulin will bind to its receptor and the cell essentially doesn't do anything. So it doesn't uptake glucose, it doesn't uptake fatty acids or amino acids or anything like that. And it appears to be this accumulation of these lipid metabolites inside of our cells that induces insulin resistance. And there are so many things that can actually increase the amount of these lipid metabolites. Cortisol itself, so glucocorticoids, they increase the release of fatty acids. They also increase fatty acid uptake. Fatty acids, when they're uptaken into a cell, they have two fates. They can be stored or they can be oxidized for energy. Let's say this is in response to some sort of psychological stress or starvation-induced stress. So starvation is a stressor. The cells may be uptaking these fatty acids because cortisol stimulates them to uptake them. But because there isn't any increased energy demand in many of these scenarios, these fatty acids remain inside of the cell without being burned. And in this context, they can interfere with insulin signaling. Therefore, things that induce chronically elevated cortisol, glucocorticoids, or adrenaline can subsequently cause insulin resistance. And what many people don't realize is that in a state of starvation, cortisol is drastically upregulated. Cortisol isn't necessarily the thing causing the stress, it's the stress causing the elevation in cortisol. So just suppressing the cortisol won't get us out of the situation. But importantly, this increased liberation of fatty acids can effectively, for simplistic sake, can gum up the insulin receptor and cause the insulin receptor to malfunction. So even in states where people are extremely lean, they can induce insulin resistance if they are overly stressed. Or probably even more important of a factor is really the only lean individuals that demonstrate any degree of insulin resistance are those who are sedentary. So if you do think about it, when you are doing physical activity, this drives the oxidation of any fatty acids that are inside of the cell. But if we're completely inactive, these fatty acids simply accumulate within our cells. And then once again, these fatty acids can inhibit the proper insulin signaling. So there's a multiple things that can induce insulin resistance that people kind of don't really think about. Other things include not having enough micronutrients or being stressed by other external factors such as heavy metal toxicity, or again, that inflammation, that in response to inflammation, you produce a lot of these cytokines, and these cytokines directly inhibit proper insulin signaling. But importantly, it doesn't appear like carbohydrates themselves induce insulin resistance unless you become overweight. So being overweight also increases your baseline level of lipolysis, which is the release of fatty acids. And the reason for this is quite fascinating. It's actually because the bigger we get, the larger our fat cells become. And when fat cells get beyond a certain point, they essentially start leaking fatty acids. And as we kind of covered, it's this leakage of fatty acids that induces insulin resistance. which is why being overweight is the main underlying factor for insulin resistance, because you have so many of these fatty acids around. And most people who are overweight, one of the reasons is because their burning of energy is lower on the lower side, whether this is due to inactivity or some other underlying factor. So they have a lot of fatty acids, but they're not burning many of them. So they begin to accumulate, leak out, and induce insulin resistance. So probably the easiest underlying factor to pinpoint for type 2 diabetes is an increase in body fat.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for walking us through a large part of your paper. And I think really as a takeaway again for people, first step should be reaching some healthy body fat levels. Now, if you're already a lean individual and you're struggling with insulin resistance, or just in general, you want to optimize your insulin sensitivity, managing stress, I would say, is probably the next best thing on top of exercising. And then you mentioned, I love how you mentioned micronutrients. So obviously food quality being super, super important. And with that, you also mentioned, you know, minimizing pesticides and all these environmental or hormone mimicking chemicals essentially, or heavy metals as well. So yeah, you've definitely touched on some really great points there. And I love how you just blanket took away that fear mostly, I think, that many people have of just, oh, carbohydrates are bad and they are associated with insulin resistance. Because as you said, especially in a state of overfeeding, so in a calorie surplus, you pointed out that the research actually indicates that a high fat, lower carb diet worsens insulin sensitivity. So something like keto or whatever, like in a calorie surplus, keto, for someone who has insulin resistance might not, or probably is not beneficial in order to help with that. So yeah, I really like that. And another thing that stood out to me in your paper was that you also mentioned that saturated fats, generally speaking, make it worse than unsaturated fats. So we want to consume more of those unsaturated fats. Is that correct?
Yeah. So if we take studies where they look at overfeeding, they can overfeed on carbohydrates and different fatty acids. So just as a brief recap, we have unsaturated fatty acids and saturated fatty acids. The big thing that differs in these molecules is simply just a few hydrogens. And it's just the amount of these hydrogens on the fatty acid that dictates whether it's unsaturated or saturated. So it does appear that saturated fats induce greater glucose intolerance than unsaturated fats, meaning that upon the ingestion of, say, 50 grams of glucose, it's much easier for someone who is co-ingesting that with unsaturated fats to regulate their blood glucose back to normal than if they were co-ingesting that with saturated fats.
Gotcha.
One of the most likely reasons behind this is actually because when it comes to the preferential oxidation of fatty acids, the body will oxidize unsaturated fats before it oxidizes saturated fats. And it's quite interesting, and there's many theories behind why this might occur. But the best way to think about it is if we consume unsaturated fats, we're more likely to oxidize them. And if we consume saturated fats, we're more likely to not oxidize them and oxidize other substrate. And one thing that's kind of important to think about here is the idea of what's called physiological insulin resistance. So in a scenario of a very low carbohydrate diet, you will effectively become insulin resistant. But this is thought to be physiological because there are many tissues in your body that require glucose. This includes your brain, certain regions of your kidney and your testes, as well as your red blood cells. So if you become insulin resistant in specific tissues such as the muscle or the liver, and this is what occurs during a very low carbohydrate diet, we can spare this glucose for the brain and the red blood cells and tissues that actually require this glucose. So in a scenario in which you're not eating carbohydrates, it's actually a beneficial thing for your muscles and for your liver to become insulin resistant, because this glucose remains in the bloodstream and can be uptaken by those glucose-dependent tissues. But in a scenario in which we're overfeeding on fat and carbohydrates at the same time, this insulin resistance is thought to be...
His dog just walked in. That's absolutely all right. Don't stress about it. You can bring him out for a second if you need to.
They should be all right. They get excited like I do.
Okay. That's all good.
All right. So, sorry, in the scenario of overfeeding on dietary fat and carbohydrates at the same time, our muscles and our liver will still become insulin resistant. But because we're also ingesting carbohydrates, these carbohydrates will remain in our bloodstream. And this is what causes an extreme elevation in blood glucose if you're combining things like a lot of saturated fat with a lot of glucose at the same time. So this insulin resistance is kind of context dependent. Sometimes it's positive and sometimes it's negative. In the scenario of inflammation, this could also be considered physiological insulin resistance. And why would that be? So if, like I said, one of the other, sorry, I haven't said this yet, but immune cells also use glucose. And in the state of inflammation, we want our immune cells to have as much energy as they can possibly have. So as a byproduct of these inflammatory cytokines causing insulin resistance, there's more glucose left in our bloodstream. And these immune cells have more fuel to uptake and then oxidize so they can fight off whatever infection or pathogen is occurring. So this is actually considered a positive thing because let's say, you know, we just had normal blood glucose levels. Our immune system may not be as strong as if we had elevated blood glucose levels due to insulin resistance at specific tissues. So it's almost like an adaptive response that we've developed throughout, you know, the millions of years of human evolution.
Super interesting. And yeah, you mentioned, I believe you mentioned zinc as an important component when it comes to healthy blood or insulin regulation, I guess. I guess that it has to do with the immune function. Is that correct?
So there's a few things, particularly for zinc, it appears to be important for the stabilization of the insulin receptor. So zinc fingers are these specific proteins that play an important function in the stabilization of many different receptors, insulin receptors and androgen receptors and things like that, which is why sometimes zinc supplementation can improve a lot of hormonal cascades and hormonal processes. So zinc appears to be really important to make sure that insulin receptor is functioning properly. Another thing is zinc can be somewhat anti-inflammatory. So if we are in the scenario of being sick, a lot of people recommend taking zinc to help get over this. Another molecule they recommend would be vitamin C. We do see in some studies that vitamin C improves insulin sensitivity by reducing systemic inflammation. So that's one of, probably the main role of micronutrients are to ensure proper energy production, ensure proper anti-inflammatory processes, and being extremely important for the entire body itself, even the insulin signaling cascade itself.
Awesome. Yeah, I have one more question in regards to that short-term beneficial effect of, you know, higher fat, lower carb potentially. And I don't know if you can answer that or from your experience, but is that sort of why some people sometimes do a keto diet or a very low carb diet to sort of reset insulin sensitivity after a while? Like, you know, it might be, let's say someone has been dieting for a show and at the end of it, they're really, really lean and insulin resistant. And then of course, obviously increasing calories, but sometimes that's done through a keto diet. Is that kind of resetting the system, quote unquote?
So I would actually say that may actually come back to the canonical view of insulin resistance, being that carbohydrates are the main driving factor of insulin resistance. So these individuals would avoid carbohydrates when trying to refeed to try and avoid insulin resistance.
Gotcha.
So I would say that if you did get blood work on these individuals and did what is referred to as an oral glucose tolerance test. So essentially an oral glucose tolerance test is when you ingest a specific amount of glucose. I believe it's typically 100 grams. And you would see how long it takes for you to essentially how long it takes for your glucose to rise and for it subsequently to fall back down to normal. In the scenario of a high fat, low carbohydrate diet, if you give these individuals an oral glucose tolerance test, it takes them far longer to get their blood glucose back to normal than someone who is eating a lower fat, higher carbohydrate diet.
Right. Interesting.
And in the scenario of diabetes, these people have completely, you know, completely off oral glucose tolerance tests in which their blood glucose may remain elevated for, you know, up to even 24 hours sometimes. Wow. Because of how insulin resistant they are. But in the context of a, so one thing that a lot of people talk about is that if you're on a low carbohydrate diet or a ketogenic diet, if you're going in to get like a gestational diabetes test, which they would give you an oral glucose tolerance test, you would actually want to reintroduce carbohydrates for a period of time so that your metabolism isn't entirely dependent off of fatty acids. Because in individuals who go into this oral glucose tolerance test on a ketogenic diet, they will look as if they're diabetic because they have this acutely impaired insulin sensitivity. It is true that if you reintroduce carbohydrates for, it's typically estimated around 48 hours, you can completely ameliorate this physiological insulin resistance.
Interesting.
Because your metabolism will shift away from predominantly dietary fat or, you know, body fat and switch towards a little bit of glucose and fat at the same time. So it is adaptive in the sense that we're sparing glucose, but you know, when you're testing it out, you may actually still appear insulin resistant. So I wouldn't say there's a lot of merit behind that philosophy, but for some people, staying on a ketogenic diet can help them maintain their body fat levels so that when they do reintroduce carbohydrates, well, they may have one or two poor days of insulin sensitivity because their body fat levels remain fairly good. As soon as they begin reintroducing those carbohydrates, their insulin sensitivity returns and it's better than it would have been if they just went hog wild and ate everything.
That makes sense. Absolutely. So yeah, I mean, that was a lot of like things that people can apply or take away from already anyway. But my question to you is now, like after researching and reading all of that and writing all of that, has that changed anything in your personal practice or like in the practice with your clients? And yeah, what's your, I guess, main clientele anyway? I'm interested.
So my main clientele, I work with actually a lot of different people. So I really enjoy working with athletes because, you know, I grew up as an athlete. So I love this specific context and I understand the implications of training, different training modalities. And, you know, I just love resistance training and that more fits the people that probably relate to me a little bit better. But I've essentially worked with everyone. I've worked with older people, younger people, people younger than me, which is surprising because I'm 18. I've worked with people far older than I am. So I've worked with people up to 60 years old. And a range in between, busy moms, professionals, things like that. So really, I work with everyone, but I specialize a lot in people who are actively pursuing a specific physical goal. So whether it's a sport, a specific physique show, or something like that, or just a physique in general, I can help with that. And then I don't so much deal with the aspects of like. Having inborn errors of metabolism or specific diagnoses, just because a lot of times there's so much blood work that needs to be done through a doctor that it gets very complicated. And sometimes what I'm saying is different than what their doctor is telling them in terms of what blood work they should get. So it gets a little bit confusing. For those people, I typically will schedule a phone consultation and we'll talk over what's going on, why it might be happening, and some recommendations on the dietary front, as well as some blood results that they can suggest. So I do love working with those people, but taking them on as a full-time coach becomes difficult sometimes.
I bet.
When it comes to my personal, so I've been aware of this literature for a few years, so probably about 2 years now. So it hasn't changed much since I've started coaching because I've only started coaching about a year, year and a half ago. I've been working people before that, but it wasn't a full-time thing. It was kind of just some suggestions and long conversations. So I've been aware of this literature for a while, but it does make you very cognizant of the idea that a lot of people talk about extremely large weight gaining when they're trying to gain weight. So not really caring about body fat, but just trying to gain as much weight as possible. And importantly, if you have reduced insulin sensitivity, this can impair your ability to put on muscle. So those with insulin resistance typically put on muscle at about 50% the rate. So in an individual who is kind of overeating on purpose to gain as much weight as possible, regardless of where it's coming from, they may actually be impairing their long-term ability to put on muscle. And the same thing occurs with someone who may be in the scenario of being kind of skinny fat. So this is a scenario in which someone has low muscle mass but high fat mass. In these individuals, it may actually be better to lose a little bit of the fat beforehand improve their insulin sensitivity a little bit, and then go into a phase that's extremely dedicated to putting on muscle. Obviously, in that weight loss phase, in these individuals, because their muscle mass is so low, you will still probably put on a little bit of muscle if your protein, calories, and micronutrients are all in check, as well as your sleep and training. But I think it primes you for a very, very productive, muscle building phase, as you would call it, if you actually lose a little bit of the fat beforehand and work on still building muscle, but not putting that as your main focus. And then finally, I guess just the idea around saturated fat. So I still don't think we have clear literature about saturated fat and unsaturated fat in terms of long-term health, because some people will tell you it's, avoid all unsaturated fat or avoid all saturated fat. It really just depends on what party you're talking to. But I do think in the concept of over-consuming saturated fat, I don't personally recommend it unless you are in a meal that you would be consuming high amounts of saturated fat. Maybe make that a lower carbohydrate meal so you're not impairing your glucose tolerance. But I'm not really a big fan of people consuming a ton of saturated fat in a given day if their goal is maintaining insulin sensitivity. Like if they already struggle with blood glucose regulation issues, these individuals, I may actually suggest eating lower in saturated fat and higher in things like monounsaturated fat, omega-7s, omega-9s, omega-3s. And I don't think that the demonization of omega-6s is quite fair. So I do think the consumption of omega-6s is not necessarily a bad thing. But I also prefer getting most of your dietary fat from food rather than from added fat. So rather than from butter or oil, I would say I would prefer someone to eat egg yolks or avocados or salmon. And when it does come to things like red meat, I'd actually prefer someone eat a leaner cut of red meat and maybe get their dietary fat elsewhere in that meal, maybe from nuts or even from avocado, something like that.
Awesome. I think, again, like very, very practical things to take away there. And what came up for me a little bit when I was reading it was also the whole chatter about like glycemic index and glycemic load, because I think that has often been like linked in the discussion with insulin, where people freak out or almost fearmonger when it comes to this food, like white rice, for instance, really high in glycemic index. And I think, at least to my knowledge, we hardly ever consume foods in isolation. We'll pair them with other things, and so then obviously that changes the glycemic load in general, and your body is going to absorb those carbs very differently if you add some almonds or like whatever you mentioned, and they're to those carbs. So that was just something that I was thinking about, but at the same time, also for people like us who are interested in resistance training, utilizing the quote unquote post-workout window or the window around your training for things like more easily absorbed carbs, because those insulin receptors are going to be so much more or like super, super receptive to anything like that. And we can actually, optimize our muscle growth that way. Those were just some thoughts. I don't know if any of that was kind of like covered in your research also, or if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I do have a few thoughts on it. I don't think I put anything specifically in that article on it, but there's definitely some things to talk about. So I do definitely agree. So after an exercise session, as mentioned, so this is one interesting thing that I'll caveat and then come back to this, but it does appear that in those who are overweight, a single exercise session improves their insulin sensitivity, just one single exercise session, demonstrating the importance of oxidizing those intracellular fats to improve insulin sensitivity. So just that one single session so let's say someone who's overweight, if they're continuously exercising every single day, their insulin sensitivity would be far better than if they weren't exercising. And so that kind of demonstrates the insulin sensitizing effects of exercise. So after a workout, because you're so sensitive to insulin, a higher insulin release in response to a higher glycemic meal may actually be a beneficial thing, because it increases the amount of this glucose that can be uptaken by your muscles, because they are the tissues that become insulin sensitive. And another thing is that insulin does have a few effects on increasing protein synthesis. So it does appear that when you compare an all-protein meal to a protein and carbohydrate meal, there really isn't much of a difference. So it does. So you don't need to add in carbohydrates to a meal that's already high in protein to further increase protein synthesis. That's kind of important. But let's say you're ingesting 20 to 25 grams of protein after a resistance training session. That may be a good time to also include some high glycemic carbohydrates, because that insulin response can essentially put you up to your maximal level of protein synthesis. So they could be they could help in muscle growth and muscle repair if you're only consuming a smaller amount of protein. Another thing that I think about a lot is the idea that high glycemic carbohydrates will make you hungry very quickly. We really don't have much evidence about this concept. And I think there's so many other factors that play into hunger that we can't just say the higher glycemic carbohydrate, the more hungry you will feel afterwards. So things like white potatoes are extremely high on the glycemic index, but they are also in the studies we have on it, are the most satiating. A boiled white potato is the most satiating food that you can consume per gram. So that's, or I think it's per calorie in those studies. So that's fairly interesting, the fact that they're extremely high glycemic, but they're also extremely satiating. And another thing is we do have, I believe there's one or two studies looking at a low or a high glycemic breakfast and subjective appetite the rest of the day. And in those studies, there doesn't appear to be much of a difference between a high glycemic or a low glycemic breakfast. And one of them that I'm thinking of right now, this was done in obese women. So it doesn't it appear that even a baseline level of insulin sensitivity or insensitivity will really dictate the appetitive response to glycemic load or glycemic index. But there are other studies indicating that, and it would make sense, but again, a lot of the things that make sense in biology and physiology don't always manifest, but that foods that are higher glycemic may increase appetite afterwards to a greater degree than lower glycemic carbohydrates. But the most likely reason for this is because if you think about a high glycemic carbohydrate, they're typically going to be very high in simple sugars and not very satiating. So orange juice is much more satiating than a whole orange. Orange juice has a much higher glycemic index than a whole orange. But the whole orange is far more satiating because it has fiber in it, and it just takes you a lot longer to actually, masticate and digest. So I think that might just be an artifact of what foods are high glycemic and low glycemic, because dietary fiber is both satiating and reduces the glycemic index. So, and things that have additional protein or fat are typically lower on the glycemic index and typically more satiating than something that is pure simple sugars like, a Rice Krispie treat or even rice. I do think that, a potato or whole fruit would be a little bit more satiating than rice. And this might be reflected in its fiber content.
Yeah, I like that you added on to those things and that your thoughts kind of go into a similar direction when it comes to, what foods might be most satiating and that playing a huge role. I'm also curious to hear, because obviously it sounds like you're trying to look at all the research when it comes to nutrition and fitness and muscle augmentation. But yeah, what things within research interest you the most at the moment, or would you, like to see more of in the future, or maybe even get into yourself more in the future?
Yeah, I definitely would like to see a few more studies looking at the glycemic index of carbohydrates. So essentially comparing meals that are high or low glycemic that are matched for what's referred to as energy density. Mm-hmm. So essentially energy density would be the amount of calories in 100 grams of a food or a specific meal. So if they were matched in energy density, but one is low glycemic and one is high glycemic, how this might affect, subjective appetite the rest of the day. Because I would like to find out if some of the narrative is true that consuming a high glycemic carbohydrate will result in more hunger later in the day, or if it really doesn't depend on the glycemic index, but rather the glycemic load and a lot of other factors.
Especially if the macros are matched as well. I think that that's super interesting, because of course we have to account for that, sometimes just at pure energy density, I don't necessarily think is going to give us the same picture as if it was like, you can be sure protein, carbs and fats and perhaps even fiber is equated for.
Yeah, absolutely. And it might be a tough study to run, but it would be fairly interesting. Another thing that I'm really interested in right now is there's a lot of things, so I essentially kind of try and go on all fronts. GLP-1 is something that I've been pretty interested in lately, and I've done a few videos on nutritional modulation of GLP-1, so ways that you can effectively get... So GLP-1 is the molecule that is mimicked by Ozempic or Wegovy. So they essentially bind to the GLP-1 receptor, and this is what causes them to reduce appetite, help regulate blood glucose, and also slow down gastric emptying and some of the other effects that extremely high levels of GLP-1 chronically can have. But there's also, we produce GLP-1 naturally inside of our intestinal tract, and different components of our food can modulate our natural production of GLP-1. So things like short chain fatty acids that are produced as a byproduct of fiber consumption, those increase GLP-1, which may be one of the reasons that they're so satiating. Amino acids also increase GLP-1. And simply just the interaction of glucose within the cells of our intestinal tract increase the production of GLP-1. But one thing that's really interesting is that the specific cells inside of our intestinal tract that produce GLP-1 are typically located further down the intestinal tract, which means that if we're consuming food that is extremely easy to digest and rapidly digested, such as fruit juice, it probably won't. One of the reasons it may not be as satiating is because we don't produce as much GLP-1, because we don't have as much food in general getting to the lower portions of our intestinal tract to stimulate the production of GLP-1. So if we're consuming things that are a little bit more difficult to break down, it may increase the production of this appetite suppressive hormone. So even the structure of a food itself can modulate GLP-1. So oats will stimulate GLP-1 more than oat flour, because the oat flour is simply a smaller particle size, so it's easier to digest. So you'll digest it more rapidly and produce a little bit less GLP-1. And there's a lot of things, like they take breads that have different particle sizes in them. So essentially breads that are a little bit more rapidly digested and or a little bit more prolonged. And the ones with the larger particle size that take a little bit more time to digest stimulate GLP-1 more and suppress appetite a little bit more. So it can come all the way down to the degree of processing of a food. And I would love to see some more studies on looking at really specific components of food, like things like more studies into particle size, like looking at the effects of, specific oats and, depending on their structure and degree of breakdown, whether or not that modulates your production of GLP-1, things like that. So there's a lot of stuff on that front that I'd like to see. And there's a lot of fascinating stuff in the literature about it.
Well, that's super cool. And no, there is already quite a few, or I can think of quite a few interesting studies when it comes to whole foods versus processed foods. You obviously, what you were talking about is a little bit more refined in the sense of specific differences between breads and all these things. But one thing that comes to mind was, I think it's been quoted quite often in many, many podcasts where they had, I think it was in a metabolic ward actually, and they had people eating ad libitum, so however much they wanted, and with one group processed foods, the other one whole foods. And I think they saw differences on average, like 500 calories higher consumption of when having access to just the processed foods as opposed to the whole foods. That was just something that popped up for me, but I also look forward to hearing more about the GLP-1. And of course, I want to make sure I respect your time. You've already given us a lot of helpful information here and of course walked us through your article. But before we finish, I would love to know what your own ambitions are with your training, if you have a particular physique or performance goal, and then of course also why you are so passionate about helping other people and maybe just in general research.
Yeah, so actually I have one caveat on that study that I think goes underlooked.
Oh, please, yes.
I do remember this. So that was a Kevin Hall metabolic ward study. He's probably the best when it comes to these. And it's interesting. So it did appear that the processed food group ate about 500 more calories every single day. But the weight loss that they saw would equate to the overconsumption of about, I believe it would be 800 calories per day.
Oh, wow.
So there's about a 300 calorie discrepancy there. And they pretty much couldn't figure it out until they looked at a specific component. So it did appear that the dietary fiber that occurred in the unprocessed diet it decreased the amount of what is referred to as metabolizable energy. So essentially, about 200 to 300 calories every single day went completely unabsorbed in the digestive tract. So the 500 calories less caloric consumption and the 200 to 300 calories that they simply didn't absorb, that is what equated to the 800 calorie difference in terms of weight loss per day. So that, I thought that was pretty fascinating.
I have never heard of this this aspect of this study. So people eat more fiber.
I believe we're speaking about the same study, but I do know.
I think that we're talking about the same one also.
Yeah. And that was fascinating. And it did appear that fiber was actually matched in the two groups. But okay. In the group consuming the processed food diet, it was a fiber supplement versus the whole food carbohydrate. Gotcha. So essentially you can think that the fiber bound in the food matrix made it more difficult to liberate all of the calories within the food, whereas a fiber supplement didn't really modulate the ability to liberate the calories in foods. Rather, it kind of just acted as a bulking agent.
Super interesting.
So I guess when it comes to me, so as unfortunate as it is, I do have a lot of issues gaining weight. So I've had it ever since the big IBS issue. If I do consume, you know, a bolus of calories within a day, I end up getting severe digestive issues. So right now, for the past few years, I've been slowly working my calories up. But, you know, if I went from, you know, 3,000 calories up to 3,500 calories, just that 500 calorie discrepancy, whether or not it's coming from really easy to digest foods like butter or even liquid food, or if it's coming from more difficult to digest foods, I end up getting a lot of malabsorption issues and just a lot of digestive distress. So at the time being, I've been gaining. So I will say at the worst, when I got to my lowest body weight, I was the same height I am now, but I was about 108 pounds. So I'm about 5'9".
Wow.
So I was extremely underweight. So over the past about 3 years, I've gained, you know, a little bit over 25 pounds.
Amazing.
So I'm slowly getting there, but as unfortunate as it is, it's just going to be a slow process and I'm going to have to live with that. But currently I lift weights every single day. As we talked about offline, it's a little bit difficult. At the time being, I actually work 4 different jobs that are scheduled. So I have 4 jobs, about 80 to 90 hours a week. In addition to the online coaching and doing school as well, where I'm in person one day a week. So this was actually my only block all week that I had time to schedule an interview. So I'm so glad that she had an opening as well. But right now I'm really just doing my best to work as hard as I can, help my family out, as well as save up money to get a full degree. Depending on what that will be, I'm not sure yet. My hope is actually, at the current moment, I'm doing bioprocess technology, which is essentially like a biotechnology degree. And my hope is that in the future, I'll be able to get a full biology degree and help merge a lot of the things that I'm really passionate about in terms of nutrition with a lot of the new biotechnology we have today. So you think of those people that are helping discover and create the medications that, you know, modulate GLP-1. I could be part of that. So doing something where I can merge a lot of the things I learned about, I have passion for within nutrition with the discovery of new medications or different things that can aid in weight loss, muscle building, preventing different diseases. That's kind of my dream. But at the time being, I'm also extremely passionate about nutrition coaching. So, the dream obviously would be to be able to have a full-time career as a nutrition coach. I think, you know, as I keep posting on social media and things like that, that hopefully will develop. And honestly, as I get a little bit older and I look a little bit more trustable, then, you know, I'll probably pick up a larger degree of people so that I can actually lose some of the jobs that I have at the current moment. So I can really focus on that, because at the moment, it's not that I'm not giving it my all, because, you know, if you look at my social medias, I have over 800 videos on all of them. But it's really just that I haven't caught the traction I need quite yet. So I still have the time to work all these jobs and do the nutrition coaching on the side.
Well, I have absolutely no doubt that you're going to grow your business. Anyone who's passionate and consistent with what they put out is going to be successful. So, I'll stay tuned for sure. And maybe you at this stage, you want to shout out your social media handles. I'll put them in the show notes, but nonetheless, where can people find you?
Yeah, so if you just look up my name on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube, you'll find me. Essentially, I post pretty much every video I've ever recorded on TikTok and YouTube. And then I make sure that the ones on Instagram are a little bit more curated to specific audiences and things like that. But I probably have about 70% of my videos on Instagram as well. So if you want all of it, check out my YouTube. and then if you go to, if you just DM me, we can discuss getting on consulting calls. So I think for most people, consultation phone calls are going to get them the best bang for the buck. So it'd just be, technically we book for an hour, but given that there's time on the front or back end, I'll always try and extend that so I can fit in as much information for them as possible. Mm-hmm. And after every coaching call, people typically leave with a plan for their nutrition. I can't write a diet plan or anything like that because I'm not certified as a nutritionist or a dietitian. So, but I can give you a lot of recommendations for based on your current circumstance. And a lot of people also leave with ideas about what blood work they might need, different things that they can try and kind of, you know, give me feedback on and see like, hey, this worked. I did tolerate this food. I didn't tolerate this food, things like that. So that consultation call gets you a lot of information at once. And the only difference between that and, you know, a full coaching program would just be that accountability thing and then the consistent updates with coaching. So if you would like to do coaching, you can actually go to the link in my Instagram biography that has the link to my website. But I think the easiest way is just send me a message so we can talk about it. Make sure that you don't sign up and then end up realizing that maybe it's not going to work out because I don't want anyone to pay me and then be like, oh, wait, I don't think I can do this. So just send me a DM. We'll discuss it. And then once we come to an agreement, we'll get going.
Awesome. Thank you, Kelvin.
Thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, or share the episode on social. Very much appreciated. You can also follow us on Instagram at Nutrition Coaching and Life, or head to our website, www.nutritioncoachingandlife.com, where we provide more valuable content. Have a wonderful day. Now go out and work on your best self.